Hey, colleagues, welcome back to the office. Welcome to our podcast for today. This is How to Select the Right Technology Provider for Your Organization, Part 1. We're actually off today, so this is a recording from a recent society conference, which I thought you might enjoy. This class, presented in two parts, is going to be discussing some of the major questions you might want to ask yourself, ask your team, ask members of your organization as you're choosing technology partners and vendors and strategies for utilizing cloud and technology services throughout your organization. We're going to be discussing some of the big questions and some of the small questions that you're going to really kind of need to think through in order to get this right for your company. In today's class, we're going to be looking at some of the big choices. We'll look at options, for example, for IT staffing that you might want to consider. We'll compare, for example, on-premise technologies, when and where you might want to use it versus their cloud counterparts. Sneak peek, cloud almost always is better in every situation, both in terms of performance, cost, reliability, stability, security, and more. We'll talk about some of the cloud shortcomings. As great as it is, there are some limitations that we should be aware of. We'll talk about some of the on-premise benefits and shortcomings as well. Now, not all types of cloud are equal. There are public clouds, there are private clouds, there's different types of strategies and approaches. Maybe you work, for example, with an infrastructure provider such as AWS or Azure. And what are some of the things that we might want to consider as we pursue these different approaches for our organization? I'll also give you some insight with respect to the experience, qualifications, and reputation that you might want to consider when choosing the exact provider that you work with. All this and more in today's podcast. Now, before we get started, I do want to remind you that our podcast for today is eligible for CPE credit. How cool is that? If you're a financial professional, and I hope you are, you can earn credits for listening to today's podcast. It's super simple. If you're watching live at the end of the broadcast, head on over to cpetoday.com and use course code SRT1. Or if you're watching after the fact on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, Spotify, or any of the other platforms we're on, same thing. Head on over to cpetoday.com, use course code SRT1, take a short 5-question quiz, and you will earn a credit for today's class. It's super simple, efficient, and easy, and it's a great way to stay on top of your credits. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get into our podcast for today. At the end of our podcast, I'll join you again. We'll go through our quick review questions for today's broadcast, and you'll be on your way. Thank you so much for being here, and I hope you enjoy the show. All righty. So we're going to go ahead and talk through some of the big choices with respect to remote access, as well as choosing a technology provider. Okay. So when we're starting to determine what our technology provider should look like, what we should be thinking about is the holistic nature of how technology is used in our firm. And we should be thinking about, for example, the different products, services, apps, platforms, and different things that we're going to be using. Okay. And so some providers, for example, are going to offer this in the traditional model where the technology, for example, just stays in place inside of our organization. And other providers, for example, are going to be offering solutions in the cloud. So some of our first big choices that we're going to have to determine here is, you know, do we stay on premise in our traditional office environment and we use remote technologies, for example, such as Citrix or remote desktop, or, you know, do we move to the cloud and do we use services such as Centrum or Microsoft Azure or Amazon? You know, this is a big decision with respect to your organization. And ultimately, this asks the question of physical custody. Is this something that I physically want to have in my office, or is this something that I am feeling comfortable with that I can put into another provider's infrastructure? Now, I could tell you personally, as a software developer, as a CPA, as somebody who's made these decisions for myself, my clients, and other people, I'm going to tell you right now, I personally think that moving to a data center is a better option for you. Not only does it offer better scalability, better security for a lot of different reasons that we're going to talk about a little bit later on, but frankly, it's just not worth the headache. You know, and out of the companies that are listed right here, I am a big fan of the Amazon Web Services. And as a second, I would choose Microsoft Azure, but Amazon is just, frankly, it's just the absolute best. And there's just nothing that even comes close. Now, we have other types of deployment methods. One of the methods that we're seeing most common now is what we call software as a service, where the applications are essentially managed on behalf of the user, and the user just interacts with it as a service. Think about your home, for example. You know, I have gas, power, water, electric, internet. Well, I don't have a power plant in my house. I don't have a pump that's pumping water from the ground into my house. There's a pipe, or there's a line, or there is something coming from a service provider directly into my property, and I consume those things on demand, you know, and I pay for what I use. Well, software could be the same thing. With software, we can essentially just receive this, and we're not responsible for any of the operations of running. Increasingly, that's not good enough. You know why? Because we have a need for different things inside of our organization. You know, some stuff we're going to want to run locally, other stuff, however, we are going to run in the cloud. And so a lot of organizations are kind of mixing these different solutions together to come up with a hybrid solution. That's pretty common. And it could be hybrid between your office and a cloud, or it could be hybrid between multiple clouds. Inside of our company, we utilize a lot of different cloud providers for a lot of different reasons. You know, there's a lot of stuff we consume from Amazon. There's a lot of stuff we consume from Microsoft Azure and others. Now, with respect to our IT staffing, okay, you know, if we go with our hosted solution, our servers and desktops run from local hardware, typically using services such as Microsoft Remote Desktop Connection, or it might be a solution such as TeamViewer or more. The other option would be that we use some sort of managed service provider where, for example, we don't interact with this directly. It's not our people using it directly, but rather we have a service provider acting on our behalf. Now, ultimately, it's going to come down to kind of where you feel most comfortable and where you would like to put your folks. A lot of people, for example, will mix and match. You know, some things they will do in-house, you know, where they'll have, for example, their own IT staff and their own IT professionals, which are working with them either on a full-time or part-time basis. And sometimes, you know, for example, you're going to utilize some sort of managed service provider that will just do it on your behalf. Now, I will point out, as a technical person, I'm a software developer, and I really, even though I don't do as much as I would like in terms of building tools, I still write code every single day, and I manage people every single day with respect to that are technical here. I will tell you, accountants aren't the best when it comes to managing technical people, so I would tell you to proceed with caution. And if your firm or your organization is large enough and you can offload this to somebody else, preferably somebody who is an engineer, who is a technical person, not only is it going to allow you to focus on the stuff that's important to you, but, you know, frankly, it's just going to work a lot better and it's going to operate a lot better as well. A lot of small firms, though, don't have that option. They don't have that luxury. You know, they have to work with the resources they have available to them. And, you know, and that's okay too. You know, what's nice is that there's a lot of really good IT services now, you know, in 2021, such as Microsoft 365 or some of the other managed services coming from the major software providers like CCH or Thomson or Intuit, you know, solutions I'm thinking like QuickBooks Online that, you know, frankly, just don't really need a lot of effort on the company side. There's really not a lot for you to do. So, I would tell you, it's kind of a mix of both. Don't be afraid of having your own staff if necessary. Typically we used to say about every 20 staff to one IT person, but you can actually get away with a lot more people now, and you don't need as many IT staff, especially if you are dealing with, cloud solutions that really just don't have a lot of overhead, and there's just not a lot for you to directly manage. All right, a question has come in. All right, let's see what we got here. Any insight on dealing with how to vet offshore outsourcing companies to meet the due diligence requirements of the AICPA, et cetera? Can you talk about the modern companies? Okay. For the first bit of this, we're going to talk about that in a little bit here with respect to vetting and compliance, SOC 1, SOC 2, 3, such. So I'm going to hold on to that question here just in a little bit. Second question came in. Can you talk about the reasons modern companies today would want to stay or need run software locally? Great question there. And really, It's going to depend on a case by case basis. There's kind of like a scalability that I would say with this, with respect to organizations. When you're really small, it makes sense to kind of do everything in house because you probably can't afford it. And the resources requirement of that would probably be difficult for a lot of people. So, you know, you might just not have the ability, for example, to go out to the cloud. You know, it just might be cheaper if you're a sole practitioner, for example, just to still have a single computer. You know, at a point though, the scalability of this becomes more important. You know, thinking out loud, for example, I would say once you get to about 6-7 people, you know, running your local network starts to have limitations with respect to it. And you start thinking about concurrency and real-time access and collaboration. And so many of these tools today really aren't designed to run locally anymore. You know, if I look at, for example, Office 365, which does include your Office licensing like Excel, PowerPoint, Word, and more, you know, frankly, I mean, that's just half the story these days. You know, if you really look at that solution, half of it, and in my opinion, the best half of it, it lives in the cloud. So, you know, I don't really get a choice. You know, it runs better, more and more effectively in the cloud. And so, you know, at some point like that, you're like, okay, man, I really do need to move to the cloud to make this effective and really kind of have a service provider to do it. And then, you know, when you get super big, you know, and I'm talking like Fortune 500, I mean, you've got, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of employees. Well, you know, it makes sense again at that economies of scale to really kind of get your own data centers and do it again in-house. So it's kind of like a sliding scale in terms of where people would go and how they would go. You know, at some point, you know, it just makes sense to bring it back in. But a lot of organizations, for example, will, I would say probably between 6 to 10 start making that decision to move out. And, you know, I would say once they get over a certain threshold, maybe in the hundreds, they start to move it back in. Now, why would you want to continue to move locally? Maybe even at that point, would you normally would move to the cloud? Well, it could be security. It could be compliance. It could be proprietary software that just isn't natively designed to run into the cloud. There's a lot of different reasons that you might choose to do that. And so ultimately, I think it would come down to the philosophy of the organization. Just saying, hey, cloud doesn't work, we don't want to do this, in my opinion, is a really bad reason to do not move to the cloud. But if you've got some specific compliance stuff, and I'm thinking around like HIPAA or PCI compliance, or maybe, for example, you're dealing with federal government data or defense data. Well, it might make sense, for example, not to be utilizing public service providers like Google or Amazon, but rather, you know, having a little bit more control in-house. Great question came, or a great comment came in here. I think for most small, medium companies, SaaS cloud apps would have stronger security than they could afford or manage locally. And I completely agree with that solution. And I completely agree with that assessment. In my opinion, if you look at cloud technology, by design, it's more secure than what you're ever going to get in your local infrastructure. Because if you think about security in general, there's two parts of it. You know, there's physical security, like my phone here. I mean, and this asks a question, can I physically pick this up and walk away with it? And the answer is yes. You know, so in a small business, I mean, you're physically managing this stuff. It physically can walk out of your office. Now, the idea that, you know, a server mounted to a rack in the back file room walking out, well, you know, that's probably unlikely, but it's still a risk nonetheless. If we think about cloud security or companies that are operating in a data center, that's just not going to happen. And we'll talk about those reasons around data center security here in a little bit. But I would tell you that when properly configured and secured, cloud technology is more secure than what you would ever get locally, because there are such large scale assurance devices, whether they be physical security, whether they be, you know, like having better infrastructure that you get with these cloud providers that just frankly are uneconomical for 99% of businesses to own. So I completely agree with that sentiment. All right, let's keep moving along here and keep our conversation going. So let's go ahead and compare our cloud versus our on-premise. Okay, with cloud-based providers, what are we typically getting? We're getting subscription-based services. They're typically managed by some sort of third party. If you think about, you know, let's say QuickBooks as an example, QuickBooks Online, I don't do anything to manage that. I'm not installing it, maintaining it, updating it, configuring security policies, backup of that. All that's managed by Intuit. You know what I do? I go in there and I will use the system to run my general ledger, do my bank feeds, do whatever else is required. But I am not running on a day-to-day basis with the actual application. It's managed by Intuit, including all the updates and security that goes along with it. The data is typically stored somewhere else. This can and cannot be a problem. I can tell you, I personally prefer when my data is patriated here in the United States. And depending on the type of data that you're working with, and where you're working with, you know, it might be a big, important thing. I could tell you, as somebody who does work with federal government, my data for that particular client has to be here in the United States. So if it's stored elsewhere, I still want to know where it's being stored and with whom and how, preferably. Typically, we'll see multiple providers. If it's a SaaS-based application, software as a service, we might, for example, see it being managed through the browser. And this is increasingly becoming more and more common. I could tell you that there was a lot of impression way back when, you know, that anything that ran in the browser was cheap and not really effective and good. I could tell you the stuff that I can build, the software I can build in a browser, in most instances is as good or better than what you would get in a thick client, like an installable application. And if anything, I think it's better because, you know what? If there's a bug fix, I can fix it immediately and the client doesn't even know the difference. It just essentially will continue to operate. And as long as they can get to the internet, they can get to their email, guess what? They can get to my application. And it's just easier and frankly better in a lot of ways. Okay, data is also secured by a third party. So in this particular case, you know, if it's QuickBooks data, it's going to be managed by QuickBooks. Now, it can be limited. I personally don't agree with this, but I will tell you that especially for newer products that are out there compared to existing desktop products, it can be limited in terms of what it will do. However, that's not always a bad thing. Again, to use QuickBooks as an example here, you know, you got QuickBooks Desktop and Enterprise, which are applications this big. You know, they're huge. Well, QuickBooks Online is not. It's much smaller, okay? But what I will tell you, and this is a phrase I like to use here, it is a thoughtful reconsideration on what an accounting system can and should do. 99% of folks use like 5% of the features inside of their accounting solution, and QuickBooks is no exception to that. Most folks aren't using a majority of the features in there, so why are you upset if that cloud application just doesn't have as much? It's not as big of a deal. I will tell you, the cloud applications most often will have the stuff that matters. And to me, that's really important. They're very scalable. Other questions that you should be considering, for example, how can you get your data in and out? That's often a big responsibility of the provider, you know, getting the data in, but getting that data out could be just as an important thing to consider. You know, if it doesn't work out with QuickBooks or it doesn't work out with whatever application you're using online, how do you get your data out of there so that you could take it back either to another provider or back on-prem? I would tell you, you should think about that before choosing a specific provider, as well as what's the disaster recovery, okay? Do not trust the provider 100% in the sense of like, I, as much as I love the different companies I work with and I vet them seriously, you know, I always still make alternative plans in case, you know, something goes bad. I could tell you, I have no problems with Microsoft SharePoint, which is our primary method of storage for our company, but I still back it up to Amazon as well. And I do that on a fairly regular basis. We run almost all of our tech on Amazon servers, but I still also do another backup to Azure just in case. I know you can't see it right now, but I've got this great tinfoil hat on that I wear most of the time just because I have seen so many things go bad over the years. I always like to anticipate where that could be. Okay, question comes in here. Do you have any shared responsibility with the cloud provider so that you cannot depend 100% on them? As I mentioned, as much as I love the different providers and vet them, I will tell you that it's better safe than sorry. And I will tell you that I always put in what? I always put in compensating controls. What are compensating controls? They are controls that exist to help offset risk, to bring it to a more manageable approach. And it's the same thing that I do, for example, if I were in an audit engagement. I want to bring and put in controls when I otherwise cannot manage that in an effective way. I want to bring that risk down to a more approachable level. So I will tell you that don't put all your eggs in one basket, and you should consider other options as well, just for your own edification and peace of mind. Now, with odd premise, okay, odd premise, we're typically purchasing a solution, okay, and this may or may not be attractive to organizations, okay? We have this idea of CapEx versus OpEx. So in this particular instance, what we should be thinking about here is, you know, do we want to put this on the balance sheet or do we want to put this on our income statement? Let me just move that over just a hair. Oops. You know, do we want to put this on our income statement or do we want to put this on our balance sheet? Okay, some organizations choose to manage from the balance sheet, and that's totally cool. I got no problem with that. In our organization, I could tell you we prefer to expense this stuff. The biggest reason is that tech is disposable. As much as I love my phone, well, in fact, I probably don't love my phone that much, but I'm going to get rid of it in 2 years. You know, I'm going to get rid of it maybe even quicker than that. And cloud tech is no different. If we buy something, we're putting it in for the long haul. I could tell you, again, as a software developer who deploys almost every project I do in the cloud, we get rid of our servers about every 6 months. I mean, we're upgrading to the latest and greatest instances coming from Amazon and from Microsoft for the different products that we develop. Why? Because it costs nothing. I can stop a machine that's running, let's say, I don't mean to be technical here, but they have these different instances types, you know, and so they got their T2, T3, T4 instances, and these are their general instances. Well, you know, 5 years ago, they came out with the T2 instances, and then they came out like 6 months later with the T3, so on and so forth. Well, with CloudTech, I stop the machine, change it from one to the other. Often it doesn't incur any additional charges, but I get advantages of all that latest and greatest tech that came out. So in my mind, I'm upgrading faster, and you should be too, than what it can justify in terms of being able to buy this stuff. So in my mind, purchasing should not be your main consideration with tech anymore. Just consider it as an expense, get it off the balance sheet, and update as quickly as we can. We're typically storing and maintaining this locally, which is, you know, cool sometimes, but for the most part, it's a concentration risk. You know, if all my backups are in that one building, what happens to that building if there's a fire or a flood or something like that? I could tell you, K2, we've always been based in Hammond, Louisiana, right outside of New Orleans. You know, when Hurricane Trina occurred, it completely wiped out the office. You know, thankfully, the company had already made the transition to Office 365, so we were able to maintain a lot of our operations. But, you know, if all of the tech, the servers, the data, the email were located in that one place, man, is that a concentration risk. And we would have to, for example, store and protect that data locally. Okay, other things that we should start to think of, you know, not everything is a bad thing. You know, for example, in this particular instance, we have options with respect to implementation. We have options with respect to security, as well as typically these applications are a little bit more rich, feature rich. Those may or may not be good things or bad things. It's just really kind of going to depend on your organization. I could tell you, security and continuity of business is your responsibility, whether you choose a cloud provider or you choose a on-premise deployment. You can offset this risk. You can compensate for this risk. You can, you know, let other people manage it for you. But I will tell you, at least in our company, the buck stops with us, and we want to make sure that we're always operating. Okay, so what are some of the cloud shortcomings, some things that we should be thinking about? Well, I will tell you, as great as the cloud is, there can be issues with speed. Most of that would arrange with internet access. I could tell you internet access is getting better, but it is not perfect. And this is especially true, for example, in organizations that are in rural areas that are having limited internet access. I just got to show you one of my newest, favoritest, most interesting things that's coming up, especially if you happen to be in a more rural area. And to put it into perspective, I live up in Big Bear Lake, California. So I'm coming live to you from my home office here in Big Bear Lake. We're a rural community outside of Los Angeles, about 2 hours high in the foothills. Internet access is okay. It's not great. But you know what's coming up that I am super excited about? Let me go ahead and share this with you. How many of you heard of a technology called Starlink? Okay. Starlink is satellite-based internet. Okay, it's high speed, low latency, and is not the satellite internet of old. This technology offered through SpaceX is going to be widely available throughout the United States in the next year or so. They started at northern latitudes. You know, they started, for example, up in Canada, and they've worked their way down south. I don't know if they're through the whole state of Texas. I'm guessing maybe towards like Amarillo, maybe northern Texas. I could tell you it's just started to become available in my area in Southern California. But unlike, you know, for example, HughesNet, where we're talking very, very low speeds, you know, a couple of megabits of bandwidth, this is like 300 megabits of bandwidth down and like 25 megabits of bandwidth up, you know. So if you've got issues with internet access, you definitely want to get on their waiting list to get this. The technology, the hardware you buy, it'll be about $500 or so, and then it'll be $100 a month for service, but it is absolutely high speed, and it is also 100% not dependent on any of the providers in your area. So if you're like me and you're not really happy with your provider, I could tell you this is going to be a fantastic option for you. Check out starlink.com. You could put in your address right here and it'll tell you if it's available in your area. I put my $100 deposit in and I can't wait. And I'm very much hoping that that will come in my area soon and hopefully for you as well. So speed can't be an issue, especially considering if you've got low quality, low speed providers in your area. Hopefully this will continue to improve. And again, with providers offering different methods of access, whether they be satellite-based or terrestrial and radio-based through providers such as Verizon, AT&T, and others, hopefully we'll be able to overcome that soon. We've got issues with integration, you know, things just not being able to tie together. A lot of organizations don't have a lot of strategic thinking when it comes to how these pieces fit. I could tell you, I spent a lot of time thinking objectively, holistically, and, you know, kind of how am I going to be able to fit all this stuff in inside of my business? And you should as well. You know, ending up with five different cloud providers is not an improvement over what you had previously. There's this idea of integrity, not having access to it. I can tell you most of these providers are getting better, but depending on the provider itself, they may or may not be a good quality provider. It's something to consider. Likewise with the security of the data. I mean, who's ultimately in charge, you know, and how is that security being applied? The good news is your major providers, your Amazons, your Microsofts, your Intuits, your Thomson Reuters, CCHs, they have so much skin in the game. It is in their absolute best interest to promote security. So generally, I'm going to tell you it's going to be taken care of for you. As long as you're following generally accepted best practices around security, generally you'll be okay. As well as this idea of control. I mean, I can tell you that when you're with a cloud provider, you don't have that. And likewise, you don't have 100% control over the sophistication or the reliability of this as well, or the governance for that matter. But I could tell you, pick a good provider and hopefully these aren't issues for you. So what are some of the data center advantages that we should be considering? Okay, so I will tell you, data centers are generally much better than anything that you could possibly set up inside of your organization. You know, I could tell you, for example, if we think about the providers such as Amazon or Microsoft, they have not put millions, but billions of dollars into building these data centers out to be appropriate and to work effectively. And that comes down into infrastructure ultimately at the end of the day. So some of the things, for example, that they've got with this, they will typically have redundant communication. You know, they're not going to just have a single, internet provider, but they'll have dozens, and often they operate them themselves. They will have redundant power to power not only the computers themselves, but all the network equipment, the cooling equipment, the security equipment that goes in there. Great providers will typically also offer what's called an SLA. An SLA stands for a service level agreement. An SLA is a written agreement from a particular service provider that says, hey, we're going to make this work. And if it doesn't work, we are going to ensure that it works. And if not, there'll be some sort of remuneration that will pop up and play into this. And it's essentially the provider telling you with really good assurance, like, we believe in our product and we're going to ensure that this works. If not, we're going to make it right with you. Let me go ahead and show you an example of this. This is from Amazon Web Services, one of my absolute favorite companies to work with. And this is for their product EC2, the Elastic Cloud Compute. Okay. This is an example of what this SLA talks about. Okay. AWS will use all commercially reasonable efforts to make sure that the services work. We are guaranteeing what is called four nines, or 99.99% uptime. And if we don't have that, if we don't hit that SLA, you will be eligible to receive a service credit. And they talk about essentially what that service credit would be, and it would be a reduction of that bill. Okay. So they tell you, for example, that, hey, if it's less than 95% reliable for a given period, we're going to give you 100% credit. So I could tell you, you know, for most of us, you know, finding anything that works 95% of the time is very hard. This is a very, very high level of standard. And I could tell you, this is why I feel so confident using providers like this, because, you know, you start thinking about the millions of customers that they have. This becomes really expensive really quickly if they don't do what they say they're going to do. Now, they will also typically have security access and control. They will have really sophisticated command centers and people in charge. And even the best of organizations will often even employ different compliance methods and compliance standards. You know, again, let's go ahead and take a look at Amazon Web Services and their different compliance standards. And I could tell you that they have invested, as has Microsoft, as has AT&T and Verizon, you know, they have a ton of different security frameworks that they put in place and compliance standards that they put in place to kind of demonstrate their competency with respect to the market. So if you go ahead and you Google search AWS Compliance Center, you can go ahead and you can review some of the different compliance that they have available. Let's go ahead and just take a look at our North American compliance. And I could tell you that they have a number of regulations that they are following, both in terms of data security. They've got, for example, stuff for HIPAA compliance. They've got stuff around SOC 3. They've got stuff around PCI compliance, HIPAA, and more. And, you know, for example, if you come over here to their compliance center for the United States, they will talk about, you know, hey, what does it look like for a financial institution to use this? What are the different regulations that you're a part of? What are some of the key considerations that we should consider? And they also, for example, have different frameworks and guidance that can offer to specific companies. And if we browse the overall compliance center, you could see that they've just got a ton of different things that they are doing for literally, I think, almost every country in the world. Let me see if I can find one more thing for you. We'll just leave it here. But this is definitely worth and considering for you with respect if you're choosing these different providers. I would tell you to ask, for example, you know, what compliance frameworks are you utilizing? And they also probably have a good provider would definitely have business continuity disaster recovery frameworks, you know, stuff that essentially, if it hits the fan, how are you going to be able to recover? I could tell you for the products that we work on, we build them in what we call a high availability or an HA environment. In fact, with some of the stuff that we've worked on, we can detect an issue right in real time and immediately roll over infrastructure to other providers. AWS, for example, has infrastructure in North America, in Ohio, Virginia, Oregon and Northern California. We typically operate in the Ohio data center and the Oregon data center, and we'll build redundancy in both those places so that if something occurs, we can go in from one to the other almost seamlessly in the background. So what are some of the on-premise shortcomings? Some of the things that we should be worried about being in our office. One of the big ones is that lack of expertise. You know, we might not have people, for example, who can manage this. And if we can get those people, do we have enough work to justify their salary? You know, a good IT manager is going to cost you $75,000 a year, you know, if they're worth their weight in gold. And if it's a service provider, a contract provider, I wouldn't be surprised just even for general help desk if it doesn't cost you 25 or 30 grand, you know. That's expensive. And often these people are hard to come by, and there can always be reliability issues. Managing that cost can be really expensive, both in terms of acquiring the equipment as well as choosing the equipment, as well as the responsiveness. You know, if they're not one of your largest clients, are they going to hop to when you have a issue? Are they going to be able to satisfy your needs? And do they have expertise in your industry and your business? Do they offer multiple sites, or do they all in one physical location? OK, Okay. What is the disaster recovery for this? You know, in terms of power outages, as well as internet outages after natural disasters, you know, I hope I'm not out of place saying this, but I'm conscious, for example, of the Texas energy crisis that happened earlier this year, you know, and what happened throughout the state of Texas was horrific and horrible. And I hope any of you that were affected by this have certainly recovered. Absolutely my heart goes out to those who were really impacted by this, you know, but from a business perspective and thinking through this, I mean, having the power go out should not negatively impact the ability for your business to be able to operate. You should be able to have that kind of redundancy and being able to roll over to other facilities if needed. And unfortunately, that didn't happen for a lot of Texas-based organizations. Okay, we have this idea of public cloud and private cloud. Okay, public cloud would be your major service providers like Amazon, Azure, Google, and others. These are typically, in my opinion, more effective and more secure than certainly what you could do on premise. And they can also be generally be less expensive for deployment than doing it yourself or choosing a another provider and having facilities like co-location in their organization. And I could tell you that 99% of people, for the most part, are choosing this public cloud hosted environment. You know, there's not, when I talk with my colleagues in the software world, I mean, I don't really think anybody now is really kind of building anything in their own data center, nor are they really kind of ever building anything in colo anymore, like with Verizon or AT&T. I mean, with AWS, and I, you know, I do this all the time, I mean, or Azure, you know, I go in there, configure a server up and running in 10 minutes without ever having to leave my desk. We just picked up a new client, really interesting company. They're incorporated in Malta. Half the company is in Prague in the Czech Republic, and the other half of the company is in Johannesburg. Okay. Well, I'm living here in Southern California. Well, we're starting to do their technology. We're doing the deployment. We're building a custom solution for them. From my office right here, you know, in Southern California yesterday, I deployed servers to the Frankfurt AWS Center and the Cape Town AWS Center. And I have technology running for that company local to them on the other side of the planet without me even having to leave the comfort of my home office. I mean, that's just incredible. I don't have to talk to anybody. I don't have to call somebody. I don't have to wait, you know, like, oh, can you please provision this? It's instantly available and instantly we can do this type of work. And so, I mean, it's allowed us to be able to acquire and work with companies all over the world. Now, we also have this idea of private cloud. Now, private cloud is something you directly control and manage. And it could be at a co-location center like Verizon, AT&T, there's plenty of other companies like Level 3 Communications and others where you could physically buy servers and put them in their place, or you could choose to do it in your office as well. Typically, this is going to be a good solution for larger organizations that want 100% control and do not want any aspect of any other organization touching their infrastructure. But for my money, it's a lot of work and I really don't see the payoff most of the time. Now, a third option here would be the SaaS, you know, for example, utilizing those browser-based tools and components. You know, it's great. It gives you really fast, centralized ability to do stuff. It's got great tools, but it also offers the least amount of control and the least amount of expertise. So, I mean, if you're utilizing, let's say, the Google Workspace tool, you know, from Google, which is their cloud-based business productivity, great solution. You have zero control over how it's deployed, the updates or upgrades. And I have a client who learned that the hard way. Their staff is not very technically sophisticated. Google will update something and it will change the way it works. And you know what? They always seem to do it. This is an accounting firm. They always seem to do it in late March, which just drives the company batty. You know, so if it's a SaaS tool, unfortunately, you have no control over that. And there's really kind of nothing for you to do for that. It just works and it will continue to operate that way. All righty, let's go ahead and go into our next section here, which is going to be on expertise, qualifications, and reputations. And so a person wrote in here earlier, it was our first question, any insight dealing how to vet offshore companies to meet due diligence requirements? Well, sir or ma'am, I'm not sure who asked this. This section is definitely going to be something for you. And it's definitely going to be something around that arena. Okay. Now I often will vet not only for my own company, but for our clients as well, the different providers and organizations that they're going to work with. And I could tell you, one of the best pieces of advice that I can get you is to get a bulldog on your side who actually knows what they're talking about. And I will also tell you, one of the best things you could possibly do is talk to an engineer and talk to somebody specific and talk with somebody who is on the operations side of this. You know, I mean, this is true for any organization and any type of business, you know, and I don't mean to be disparaging to people who work in sales, but generally sales folks, business development folks do not know what they're talking about, nor do they have the expertise to really answer very minute, tiny questions that might have a massive impact on the organization. And so I could tell you, I try to blow past the salespeople as much as I can. And I try to talk to the engineers and the people who actually know what they're talking about. And if any of you ever have any questions on a provider or need somebody who essentially to represent your interests, shoot me an email. I just love helping folks and I love making sure people don't make a bad decision when it comes to choosing their provider, because often backing out of this stuff can be a nightmare, especially if you look at long-term contracts and we look at some of the complications that can arise from exfiltrating data. Finding a good provider that meets the actual qualifications and needs of the organization should be priority one, and it should be what your organization spends its most time doing when choosing. I mean, because once you choose a provider, I mean, things like cost, yes, they're going to be important, and that should be a consideration, but it should not be your only consideration. As an engineer, I consider myself an engineer. As a developer, you know, when a client jumps to cost immediately, to me, that's a signal that that's the question. That's the only thing they know about what we're talking about. You know, if the conversation immediately goes to cost, well, often that's the wrong question to be asking. It should be a value-driven question. It should be about, you know, how this is going to work and operate inside the organization. We'll make the money work, and it might be more than we want to spend, but if it avoids an issue, it's a better provider, you know what? That's worth it in a lot of ways, because the pain, hassle, and headache of backing out of this can be incredible, and it's just often not worth it. So check the reputation, find the vendor that's going to work for you, ask them technical questions, try to speak to an engineer. Those are my best pieces of advice. Now, how are other ways that we can vet this? Well, I would tell you one of the best things that you could possibly do is talk to other business area, other owners in your area, as well as people in your industry and market. You know, let's say you are a restaurant company, you know, based in the Austin area. Well, go around, talk to other restaurateurs and find out what point of sale system or what disaster recovery system or what credit card provider works well for them. Often, even if I have no interest in working for a company, I'll go through their sales pitch, mostly just to have contrast when I'm looking and evaluating different providers. You know, it gives me an idea of feature, price, service, quality, all those kind of stuff. And a lot of that will usually come from just talking with other providers in the area. You can also check other things like the Better Business Bureau, the Chamber of Commerce. Mileage will vary. Social media is a really good way of checking things, but I will also tell you that from my experience, mileage will vary. I find with social media stuff, especially reviews like on Yelp or Google Maps, you get the really, really good and the really, really bad. You know, most folks don't care. You know, most folks won't even leave. So take it with a grain of salt. You know, you're usually getting people on their best or worst day. I generally don't use Yelp. If you are going to use a service such as this, you know, I find Google Maps to be a little bit more reliable. Now, if you want to understand what kind of company they are, there's no better way than determining that from the inside out. Services such as Indeed or Glassdoor can be really fantastic in terms of determining, you know, are they a good quality company? Oh, I just want to point out the boss is here. That is my the head of accounts retrievable for our company. That is Winston the poodle. So I guess he's here to make sure this is a quality conference. So thank you for being here, Winston. And, you know, we can also check, for example, other publicly known databases on the financial side of this, for example, the Dun & Bradstreet. And, you know, honestly, there's nothing wrong with asking a company, hey, can you connect me with a couple of your previous customers? I'd like to get some idea and talk with them. I find talking with one or two customers personally to probably be the overall best solution. And, you know, usually will give me the best insight in terms of what I am specifically looking for. Alrighty. So I will tell you, in terms of experience and qualifications, generally size is important, but it depends on where that size is important. If it comes to a data center, you know, size is massively important. I mean, the infrastructure requirements for this and the cost is so astronomically large. Bigger is better, you know, and I'm going to trust, for example, the provider like Amazon or Azure or Rackspace, great Texas company, way more than I'm going to trust Bob's Computer on Main Street. However, when it comes to a software development company, when it comes to choosing a provider, you know, that's going to implement this, in my opinion, medium size is more important. I wouldn't necessarily want a sole prop, an individual person, but, you know, and I wouldn't want a massively large company either because I want someone to be attentive to my needs. I would consider, for example, how many techs and engineers do they have? What kind of support employees do they have? For me personally, being based in the United States is massively important. I can tell you for our company, 100% of our staff is based in the USA, and that's important to us. Not only from a sense of wanting to employ people here in the United States, but also I think it's important to our customers that, you know, that they know that their data, their technology is not leaving the shores of the US and that we're held to the same standards that they are. Now, if you do have employees outside the US, how do they have access? Is it secured? I mean, can you control these people? I could tell you that I like to look at the bios, the education, and the current certifications of the people who are on those teams. You know, I like to know who I am working with, and checking the employee's website as well as services such as LinkedIn can be really helpful. How large is your organization? How are you organized? Are you looking at providers, for example, that are organized by industry, geography? You know, like there are certain providers. A great provider that I absolutely love, and I'm shamelessly plugging their business, is NMGI, Network Management Group. Many of you know Randy Johnson, a longtime K2 instructor. I mean, his group, NMGI, is fantastic. They're based in Hutchinson, Kansas. They service the needs of accounting organizations. And that's what they focus on. And it doesn't matter that they're based in Hutchinson. They service companies all over the United States and they do a fantastic job. And they know, Randy knows more about accounting system than any person that I have ever come across in my life. And I would trust him more than anybody else for helping me choose an accounting solution or implement it inside of my organization. The fact that he's 2,000 miles away in the middle of the country doesn't really matter. It might have mattered in 94, 95, 2005, 2021, man, we're all working from home. It doesn't really matter anymore. But, you know, if you do have a physical office and you need somebody to come fix a printer, geography could be important. You should be thinking about the size of your clients. What's the smallest, average, biggest, you know, what kind of attention they're going to need? How many clients do you have in that specific area? How many clients do you have in that specific industry? Do you have clients that need to support multiple things at the same time? We're all doing a lot of stuff now, and concurrency is something that we should consider. Okay, as we're talking through our providers, what kind of support can we expect? You know, what's the turnaround time? Part of that will come into that SLA, that service level agreement, you know, and they could also, for example, have an escalation policy as well. You know, they might have, for example, have a critical bug, you know, impacting, and this is typically how we do it. You know, is it a tier 1, 2, or 3 issue? Is it impacting one user, a group of users, or all users, like a system outage, you know, and there's different SLAs, service level agreements, for resolution. I could tell you, for example, if it's affecting a user, it might be a 24-hour turnaround. If it's affecting a group of users, it might be a 6-hour turnaround. If it is affecting all users, like a system offline, well, that's all hands on deck. Let's get this resolved as ASAP. And you should be thinking about what this policy is. What's, you know, for example, what kind of support you can expect and what's that going to cost for extended support, as well as, you know, what if it happens on March 20th at midnight? You know, those are things that you're going to want to think about and consider. So understanding where and how things are going to be resolved, you know, understanding how are things going to resolve both in terms of issues as well as, hey, you know, sometimes just things don't work out and we're not happy with the service. Well, how can we get out of it? You know, are there penalties for our early termination? If so, what are they? Likewise, I mean, can we get our data out? Some of these cloud-based providers and some of these SaaS-based providers are designed in such a way that it's just not easy. You know, it's just not easy for them to be able to get the data out, especially if it's commingled with other organizational data. It can be impossible depending on the nature of how that operates. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Let's go ahead and have some review questions on the material that we discussed and learned in today's presentation. Our first review question: what's a good resource to validate a vendor's reputation? Is it a flyer on a telephone pole? That wouldn't be my first choice. Is it a unsolicited email from an account that you don't recognize? Nope, that would not pass my test at all. Would it be reviews on the vendor's website? Maybe. I mean, that could be okay, you know, especially if it's a pretty widely known and well-accepted vendor with a good reputation. But still, you know, that would not be my first recommendation. What I would recommend for you is that with any service provider that you're going to look at, it's always best to get a referral from somebody you trust, a colleague that knows what they're talking about, that has experience, that has your vested interest at heart is always preferred. And if that's not possible, you know, you might want to ask the vendor, for example, for a reference for another organization that they've recently worked with that is similar to your own organization. That can be really helpful in terms of establishing trust and being able to ask questions. And in fact, I would say that would be a fabulous thing to do as a matter of due diligence and proper planning. Let's have our next question. What are accountants notoriously bad at managing? Is it clients? You know what? That's not bad. I think we, hopefully with most of our firms here, we've gotten our clients whipped into shape for how we want them to work with us. Is it client communications? Well, sometimes they can certainly lag with respect to getting back to us, especially if it's something like an 8879 or a letter that needs to be signed or something like that. The correct answer here would be IT staff. IT people generally are very technical. They live in their own world. They speak in acronyms. These are my people. I often like to think that, for example, I serve as a translator between business people and technical people, helping each side understand what the other is saying. I like to think, for example, I help business leaders make good technical decisions and then communicate the decisions that they make to the IT staff and software developers who will ultimately be building those products. Our third question: what technologies have been helped by cloud data service providers? Is it lower price storage area networks or SANs? You betcha. There are plenty of SAN services now that are far cheaper on the cloud than you could ever get inside of your office and at a really good reliability. Is it more effective and secured remote desktop and virtual desktop tools? You betcha. Is it cheap unmetered internet access? Well, in a lot of ways, cloud certainly has facilitated a lot of that and made those services a lot easier to work with. So I'm going to say all of the above. So thank you for joining us. Let's go ahead and do a quick recap about what we learned. Well, today we discussed the benefits and risks of using cloud tech, as well as some of the benefits and risks of on-premise technology and why you might want to consider one or the other, and sometimes maybe both. We talked about how to select from a list of different approaches and how to deliver applications and experiences to our end users. We talked about how to identify good IT providers, and we started working through some of the qualifications and characteristics and things you might want to ask with respect to choosing a reputable vendor in this in cloud tech. Now, in the next episode of this, we are going to continue to dive into this topic and explore some of the different meanings associated with IT certifications and, you know, what you actually might want to ask your IT provider in terms of how they're going to build your stuff, what direction they're going to go in, you know, their particular strategy and approach. We'll talk about all the different types of software, hardware that you might want to consider. And we'll also talk about some of the critical risks that you might want to avoid. I'll try to give you as many tips, tricks, and hazards and how to avoid them and how to avoid those hazards as I possibly can. Now, I do want to remind you that today's podcast is eligible for CPE credit. So if you are a financial professional, you can earn a credit for listening or watching today's course. It's super simple. Head on over to cpetoday.com, use course code SRT1. You'll take a short 5-question quiz and you will earn a certificate for today's course. It's fast, efficient, and easy. It's a great way to stay on top of your license. If you like today's podcast, please consider following us on social media or subscribing to our channel on YouTube or Facebook. You can also get copies of our podcast on wherever you choose to get media, whether it be Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Facebook, and more. We're coming to you live twice a week, Tuesdays and Fridays at 11 a.m. Pacific, and always available on demand on the streaming platform of your choice. We love you. Thank you so much for being here. It is an absolute pleasure, and we look forward to seeing you back in the office the next time around. Take care and have a great day.